Namaste. We stand a good chance of finishing this chapter, Sankhya and Yoga, tonight. It's the eighth chapter in Sri Aurobindo's series on the Gita. We've been describing the functioning elements of the Sankhya system, and we noted along the way that there are various stages in its historical development, and an earliest phase probably we see in the early Upanishads, a sort of a middling stage where we have the rough outlines of what will become Sankhya later is what we see in the Gita, in the Mahabharata, some of the Puranas. But the the deep analysis of nature with the enumerated 24 principles of existence, in addition, of course, the 25th, if you want to count it, would be the Purusha who watches all of this natural activity, is not extant at the time that the Gita is composed. That very elaborate system came a good deal later, several hundred years, maybe 1,000 years later. But we read backwards into it, since we didn't have, early in the 20th century, a good index of what were the historical markers. It's easy to take the Sankhya system that we know through the Karikas and transplant it back into the Gita and think that the Gita is speaking to that. It isn't quite so. Nevertheless, we're going to take Sri Aurobindo's essay as it stands, without too much analysis of Sankhyan analysis, and go forward from here. The Gita starts from this analysis, and seems at first, even in its setting forth of yoga, to accept it almost wholly. It accepts Prakriti and her three gunas and 24 principles, accepts the attribution of all action to the Prakriti and the passivity of the Purusha, accepts the multiplicity of conscious beings in the cosmos, accepts the dissolution of the identifying ego sense, the discriminating action of the intelligent will, and the transcendence of the action of the three modes of energy as the means of liberation. So if we're looking for citations in the Gita to support this, we would go to chapter 13, shloka 5, and chapter 15, shloka 7. The yoga which Arjuna is asked to practice from the outset is yoga by the buddhi, the intelligent will. You'll remember from our survey of the principles of Prakriti that the buddhi, also called mahat, stands at the crown of all of natural creation. And so would be the closest thing to knowledge that one can attain within the field of Prakriti. So it is through the yoga of buddhi, buddhi yoga, that Arjuna will be able to deliver himself free from the fetters of natural entanglements and arrive at that which is imperishable, the reality of the Atman, the Akshara Purusha. But there is one deviation of capital importance. The Purusha is regarded as one, not many. For the free, immaterial, immobile, eternal, immutable self of the Gita, but for one detail, is a Vedantic description of the eternal, passive, immobile, immutable Purusha of the Sankhyas. This is so. For Sri Aurobindo's reading of the Gita, it is a secured point to recognize that the multiplicity of Purushas, which drives that system into philosophic bankruptcy 1,000 years later, is not the position of the Vedanta, and the Gita is a Vedantic text. The Gita is looking to synthesize, to fuse together, to unite all apparent contradictions of existence in a greater whole. It is a unified spiritual theory, if you will. But the capital difference, Sri Aurobindo writes, is that there is one and not many. This brings in the whole difficulty which the Sankhya multiplicity avoids and necessitates a quite different solution. This the Gita provides by bringing into its Vedantic Sankhya the ideas and principles of Vedantic Yoga. You do remember, I think, that the difficulty with there being one Purusha and one Prakriti is that if Purusha becomes liberated from Prakriti, then everything that shares Purusha's status should be instantaneously liberated. So if one of us gets liberated, then all other Purushas should be liberated too. And so they have that philosophic problem to resolve. The Gita, while it's philosophic, is based upon a synthetic spiritual experience. And actually, while it's going to draw a lot upon its Vedantic, that is Upanishadic bases, it goes beyond. It goes beyond what the Upanishads themselves declare. But there's a lot in the Upanishads that presage what is in the Gita. Let's push forward and we'll see some of it. The first important new element we find is in the conception of Purusha itself. Prakriti conducts her activities for the pleasure of Purusha. But how is that pleasure determined? In the strict Sankhya analysis, it can only be by a passive consent of the silent witness. Passive, not acting, ever. Passively, the witness consents to the action of the intelligent will, buddhi, and the ego sense, ahankara. Passively, he consents to the recoil of that will, buddhi, from the ego sense, ahankara. So we can see the movement forward and the movement back are both actions within nature, within Prakriti, within its construct. Purusha hasn't done anything. It hasn't really entered into anything. It hasn't had to withdraw itself from anything. He is witness, source of the consent, by reflection, upholder of the work of nature. Sakshi anumanta bharta, but nothing more. Upadrashta anumanta cha, Gita 13:22. Also, chapter 9, 18. But the Purusha of the Gita is also the Lord of nature. He is Ishvara. Ishvara means Lord. Ishvara sarva bhutanam. The Gita says in chapter 18, 61st shloka. If the operation of the intelligent will belongs to nature, the origination and power of the will proceed from the conscious soul. He is the Lord of nature. So the Gita is not having any of this idea that the Purusha has no power, has no will. He is absolutely filled with power. It is this supreme being, this Ishvara, who sets forth all the working of nature from buddhi all the way down to the field of gross matter. All of it is impelled forward by an act, by an edict, by a fiat of the divine. It isn't that he's the passive lord of nature. Remember, he also enters into it, never absent from the universe for a moment. If the operation of the intelligent will, buddhi, belongs to nature, prakriti, the origination and power of the will proceed from the conscious soul. This is the Purusha. He is Lord of nature, Ishvara. It's worth repeating because this will dominate the possibilities of a synthetic yoga which Arjuna will be asked to bring into his own personal compass by the end of the Gita, where he will be asked to live in identity with the Supreme and to reflect that Supreme will through his actions in the world, and thus restore the world order, which is threatened by the battle about to commence at Kurukshetra. If the act of intelligence of the will is the act of prakriti, the source and light of the intelligence are actively contributed by the Purusha. He is not only the witness, but the Lord and knower, master of knowledge and will, Jnata Ishvara. Now that term does not occur in the Gita, at least I can't find it. But you can see what he means. He means the Ishvara, the Supreme Lord, who is full of knowledge. He is the supreme cause of the action of prakriti, the supreme cause of its withdrawal from action. So from the Lord's own inner being comes forth the universe, compelled into action. And then, by the Lord's will, the Purusha's sanction is withdrawn. In the Sankhya analysis, Purusha and Prakriti in their dualism are the cause of the cosmos. In this synthetic Sankhya, Purusha by his Prakriti is the cause of the cosmos. So you see, in the Sankhya system, Purusha is minding it his own business, and suddenly Prakriti gains his view, and so comes into being the universal action. But to the Gita, what Sankhya describes is that Purusha, leaning into his prakriti, into his own nature, develops the universe. It is not an accident. It is a concerted will. We see at once how far we have traveled from the rigid purism of the traditional analysis. Well, that's where the traditional analysis would take its philosophic leanings a few hundred years from then. It is a later tradition. But what of the one self, immutable, immobile, eternally free, with which the Gita began? That is free from all change or involution in change, avikarya, unborn, unmanifested, the Brahman. Yet it is that by which all this is extended. That's chapter 2, shloka 25. Therefore, it would seem that the principle of the Ishvara is in its being, inside it. If it is immobile, it is yet the cause and Lord of all action and mobility. But how? And what of the multiplicity of conscious beings in the cosmos? They do not seem to be the Lord, but rather very much not the Lord, Anisya, 16:8. for they are subject to the action of the three gunas and the delusion of the ego sense. And if, as the Gita seems to say, they are all the one self, how did this involution, subjection, and delusion come about? Or how is it explicable except by the pure passivity of the Purusha? And whence the multiplicity? Or how is it that the one self in one body and mind attains to liberation while in others it remains under the delusion of bondage? These are difficulties which cannot be passed by without a solution. So the Gita has to take them up at least in a suggestive way. So from the one, how do we get to the many? It is an age-old problem. The Gita answers them in its later chapters by an analysis of Purusha and Prakriti, which brings in new elements very proper to a Vedantic yoga but alien to the traditional Sankhya. It speaks of three Purushas, or rather a triple status of the Purusha. This would be chapter 15, shlokas 16, 17. The Upanishads, in dealing with the truths of Sankhya, seem sometimes to speak only of two Purushas. Remember, they're talking about a triple status in the synthesis we find in the Gita. So, two Purushas in the Upanishads? Well, if we're looking for antecedents in the Upanishads, we have to go to the Katha, Shvetashvatara, Chandogya. In Chandogya, we could go to 6-4-4, Shvetashvatara to 4-5, and also to 6-3-4, to the Maitri Upanishad, to chapter 6, verse 10, chapter 7, verse 3. I can see you all busily writing this down. To the Mangala, the Pangala, chapter 1, verse 6 and 7. We'll get to the Brihadaranyaka in a moment. So let's read that sentence again. The Upanishads, in dealing with the truths of Sankhya, seem sometimes to speak only of two Purushas. It's only in the later Upanishads that anything like Sankhya is mentioned. The earliest, no mention of it per se. There is one unborn of three colors, says a text. The eternal feminine principle of Prakriti with its three gunas ever creating. There are two unborn, two Purushas, one of whom one cleaves to and enjoys her, the other abandons her because he has enjoyed all her enjoyments. Well, the three colors we certainly find in Chandogya, and it's worth noting that the idea that we're about to enter into has a vast legacy to it. In another verse, they, these two Purushas, are described as two birds on one tree, eternally yoked companions, one of whom eats the fruits of the tree, the Purusha in nature, enjoying her cosmos. The other eats not, but watches his fellow, the silent witness, withdrawn from the enjoyment. When the first sees the second and knows that all is his greatness, then he is delivered from sorrow. So we find this in the earliest form, in the Rig Veda, in the first mandala, hymn 164, the 20th Rig, 20th verse. But we also see this in the Mundaka Upanishad, chapter 3, first section, verses 1 through 3. In the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, the fourth chapter, the sixth verse, And in the Katha Upanishad, in I think it's in the first section, no, the first chapter, the third section, verse 1. Also note, Sri Aurobindo has earlier written about these two birds on a common tree, the one of whom stands above, one sits on a branch below and eats the sweet and bitter fruit and suffers joy but also sorrow and is confused, bewildered. But when he turns his glance above and he sees that bird watching from the higher branch, then his sorrow disappears because he realizes, ha, that is me. So it's like there aren't two purushas, but it's oneself, yes? With two poises. There is only one person, after all. So that is how we get free. We recognize we have a high... Does it mean that the bird on the lower branch leaves? No, he continues to sit on the world tree, the tree of Prakriti, and continues to deal with the fruit, sweet and bitter. But now, knows what he is. Ha. The point of view in the two verses is different, but they have a common implication. One of the birds is the eternally silent, unbound self or Purusha by whom all this is extended, and he regards the cosmos he has extended, but is aloof from it. The other is the Purusha involved in Prakriti. Remember too how Sri Aurobindo noted Nara and Narayana, the eternal pair. Narayana, the universal spirit who supports the universe, the cosmos entire, and Nara, who in essence is identified with Narayana, but has to recognize it. And as he comes to recognize it, then he enters into the ocean of bliss and enters freely into true being. Before I wander away, I want to read something from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. This is from the second chapter, the fifth section therein, and the first verse. This earth is like honey for all creatures, and all creatures are like honey for this earth. This shining, immortal person who is in this earth and with reference to oneself, this shining, immortal person who is in the body, he indeed is just this self. This is immortal. This is Brahman. This is all. So the individual soul come to know itself as the essence of real being is one with all the cosmos. And it is a cycle, a communion, a recycling, a circling through of bliss, leading to other bliss, bringing back bliss to the initiator. Back to our essay. Remembering the two birds. The first verse indicates that the two are the same, represent different states, bound and liberated, of the same conscious being. For the second unborn has descended into the enjoyment of nature and withdrawn from her. The other verse brings out what we would not gather from the former, that in its higher status of unity, the self is forever free, inactive, unattached, though it descends in its lower being into the multiplicity of the creatures of Prakriti, and withdraws from it by reversion in any individual creature to the higher status. This theory of the double status of the one conscious soul opens a door, but the process of the multiplicity of the one is still obscure. So again, we come to that idea, high self, low self, one self. But how does it happen? To these two, the Gita, developing the thought of other passages in the Upanishads, adds yet another, the Supreme, the Purushottama, the highest Purusha, whose greatness all this creation is. So here's how we resolve it, because we have an antinomy and we can't really unite it. We have something in time, something out of time. How do we bring them together? There's a footnote here. Purusha, aksharat parataha para. Although the akshara is supreme, there is a supreme Purusha higher than it, says the Upanishad. So the Upanishad is the Mundaka Upanishad. It's the second chapter. It's the second verse. And it says, rendered into English by Sri Aurobindo, He, the divine, the formless spirit, even He is the outward and the inward, and He, the unborn. He is beyond life, beyond mind, luminous, supreme, beyond the immutable. It's a suggestion. So, inside, outside, free, but also beyond even this freedom of the immutable spirit of Brahman. Thus, there are three. The Kshara, the Akshara, the Uttama. Kshara, the mobile, the mutable, is nature, Swabhava. It is the various becoming of the soul, chapter 2, shloka 14. The Purusha here is the multiplicity of the divine being. It is the Purusha multiple, not apart from, but in Prakriti. Akshara, the immobile, the immutable, is the silent and inactive self. It is the unity of the divine being, witness of nature, but not involved in its movement. It is the inactive Purusha, free from Prakriti and her works. A later tradition, and even part through the Upanishads, this will be called Atman, referred to as the inner self of being, the subjective aspect of reality, and as Brahman, when we see it as the whole, as in the biggest picture. It is by a large mobility and action of his nature, his energy, his will and power, that he manifests himself in the world, and by a greater stillness and immobility of his being, that he is aloof from it. Yet is he, as Purushottama, above both the aloofness from nature and the attachment to nature. So we see how those words combine. Purusha, the self, Uttama, the supreme, the ultimate. So Purusha, Uttama, Purushottama, brought together, the supreme soul. This idea of the Purushottama, though continually implied into Upanishads, is disengaged and definitely brought out by the Gita and has exercised a powerful influence on its later developments of the Indian religious consciousness. We've made several notes about this before. Let's note here chapter 15, shloka 18. It is the foundation of the highest bhakti yoga, which claims to exceed the rigid definitions of monistic philosophy. It is at the back of the philosophy of the devotional Puranas. So this would be the Vedantic philosophy of Ramanuja. And by the way, Ramanuja's commentary, his Bhashya on the Bhagavad Gita, is one of the supreme works of India's spiritual literature and worth your perusal. You can get it for free online. If you can't find it, contact me. I'll send it to you. In terms of the devotional Puranas, obviously, the two that Sri Aurobindo held closest to him were the Vishnu Purana and the Bhagavatam. The Gita is not content either to abide within the Sankhya analysis of Prakriti, for that makes room only for the ego sense and not for the multiple Purusha. In other words, if we regard the individual and we stick with a Sankhya system as we come to see it in the Karikas, then the only point of individuality comes when nature mistakenly assigns itself a sense of I, ahankara. The Gita is not content either to abide within the Sankhya analysis of Prakriti, for that makes room only for the ego sense and not for the multiple Purusha, which is there, not a part of Prakriti, but separate from her. The Gita affirms, on the contrary, that the Lord, by his nature, becomes the Jiva. Chapter 7, Shloka 5. Leaning upon his own nature, he produces the Jiva Bhuta. How is that possible, since there are only the 24 principles of the cosmic energy and no others? Chapter 15, Shloka 7. Yes, says the divine teacher, in effect. That is a perfectly valid account for the apparent operations of the cosmic Prakriti with its three gunas, and the relation attributed to Purusha and Prakriti there is also quite valid and of great use for the practical purposes of the involution and the withdrawal. But this is only the lower Prakriti of the three modes, the inconscient, the apparent. There is a higher, a supreme, a conscient and divine nature, and it is that which has become the individual soul, the jiva, So there is a supreme nature, para prakriti. We won't see him deal with that in this chapter, that will come later. But the three modes with which we are familiar, the three gunas, belong to the lower nature, regular Prakriti, not the supreme nature. But these bright sparks of soul being, which proceed forth from the higher nature, are superior to the modes of ordinary nature, and yet invest and identify themselves in it. This is the mystery of existence that he will unroll to us here. In the lower nature, each being appears as the ego. In the higher, He is the individual Purusha. In other words, multiplicity is part of the spiritual nature of the One. It isn't the One numerically. It is the One in terms of its essence and its coherence. The many pre-exist in the One, and they are issued forth into manifestation by deliberate action on the part of the Purushottama. It is not a mistake. It is not a cosmic error. This individual soul is myself. In the creation, it is a partial manifestation of me, mammaiva anshaha. And it possesses all my powers. This is the Purushottama speaking, the Supreme Being saying this. It is witness, giver of the sanction, sakshi, anumanta, upholder, upadrashta, knower, jnana, lord, isha. It descends into the lower nature and thinks itself bound by action so to enjoy the lower being. So even the self-forgetting is something deliberately accepted by the jiva as it enters into the cosmic field. It can draw back and know itself as the passive Purusha free from all action. It can rise above the three gunas and liberated from the bondage of action, yet possess action, even as I do myself. And by adoration of the Purushottama in union with him, it can enjoy wholly its divine nature. So here's what the third person, the Purushottama, just said. You can be identified with the action in the lower world so as to enjoy it, and I've sent you there. No problem. You can be free. You can rise above and live in a spiritual status where you're not identified with it. But you can also know yourself as me by, look what he says here, by adoration and union with him. How do you unite? You have to know, you have to work, you have to love. And by doing all that, and this is chapter 14, shloka 26, doing all that, it can enjoy its divine nature, so rise to that third status. This seems to be the intended goal for at least the select who have entered into cosmic action. This is a path clearly laid out by the Purushottama. Rise to my highest nature. Ah, look, Vasanti Rao has joined. I guess the higher nature is here. Paraprakriti stands in the field. Such is the analysis, not confining itself to the apparent cosmic process, but penetrating into the occult secrets of superconscious nature. Uttamam Rahasyam, Chapter 4, Shloka 3, by which the Gita founds its synthesis of Vedanta, Sankhya, and Yoga, its synthesis of knowledge, works, and devotion. By the pure Sankhya alone, the combining of works and liberation is contradictory and impossible. By pure monism alone, the permanent continuation of works as a part of yoga and the indulgence of devotion after perfect knowledge and liberation and union are attained become impossible, or at least irrational and otios. The Sankhya knowledge of the Gita dissipates, and the yoga system of the Gita triumphs over all these obstacles. So, just to dwell on the verses from the Gita, this is the 26th and 27th shlokas. He who loves and strives after me with an undeviating love and adoration passes beyond the three gunas, and he too is prepared for becoming the Brahman. I am the foundation of the silent Brahman and immortality, imperishable, the home of Dharma, and absolute bliss. Sukhasya ekantitasya. So, Sri Aurobindo has now introduced to us the idea of a third station, not simply being immersed and caught in the conflicts of a bewildering universe, or of gaining an exit from it, which renders us free but passive to the world, but a way to join ourselves to the Supreme Spirit and act continuously with love from knowledge in identity with this Supreme Person and be able to carry forward the universal work, the Sanatana Dharma. Establish what is right and good and true, what is progressive. And that is the secret of the Gita, and an improvement, an advance in clearest terms over what had been the reigning teaching for by then 1,000 years. So, to find a passage that was complementary to this, I'm going to turn to Savitri, Book 2, the Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 5. Well, it's the Godheads of the Little Life, but I think you'll like this, at least a little. This was a toy to amuse the infant earth, but knowledge ends not in these surface powers that live upon a ledge in the ignorance and dare not look into the dangerous depths or to stare upward, measuring the unknown. There is a deeper seeing from within. And when we have left these small purlieus of mind, a greater vision meets us on the heights, in the luminous wideness of the spirit's gaze. At last, there wakes in us a witness soul that looks at truths unseen and scans the unknown. Then all assumes a new and marvelous face. The world quivers with a godlight at its core. In time's deep heart, high purposes move and live. Life's borders crumble and join infinity. This broad, confused, yet rigid scheme becomes a magnificent imbroglio of the gods, a game, a work ambiguously divine. Our seekings are short-lived experiments, made by a wordless and inscrutable power, testing its issues from inconscient night to meet its luminous self of truth and bliss. It peers at the real through the apparent form. It labors in our mortal mind and sense, amid the figures of the ignorance, in the symbol pictures drawn by word and thought. It seeks the truth to which all figures point. It looks for the source of light with vision's lamp. It works to find the doer of all works, the unfelt self within, who is the guide, the unknown self above, who is the goal. All is not here a blinded nature's task. A word, a wisdom, watches us from on high. A witness sanctioning her will and works, an eye unseen in the unseeing vast. There is an influence from a light above. There are thoughts remote and sealed eternities. A mystic motive drives the stars and suns. In this passage from a deaf, unknowing force to struggling consciousness and transient breath, a mighty supernature waits on time. The world is other than we now think and see, our lives a deeper mystery than we have dreamed. Our minds are starters in the race to God, our souls deputed selves of the Supreme. Across the cosmic field, through narrow lanes, asking a scanty dole from fortune's hands, and garbed in beggar's robes, there walks the One. Even in the theater of these small lives, behind the act, a secret sweetness breathes, an urge of miniature divinity. A mystic passion from the wells of God flows through the guarded spaces of her soul, a force that helps supports the suffering earth, an unseen nearness and a hidden joy. There are muffled throbs of laughter's undertones, the murmur of an occult happiness, an exultation in the depths of sleep, a heart of bliss within a world of pain. An infant nursed on nature's covert breast, an infant playing in the magic woods, fluting to rapture by the spirit's streams, awaits the hour when we shall turn to his call. In this investiture of fleshly life, a soul that is a spark of God survives. And sometimes it breaks through the sordid screen and kindles a fire that makes us half divine. In our body's cells, there sits a hidden power that sees the unseen and plans eternity. Our smallest parts have room for deepest needs. There, too, the golden messengers can come. A door is cut in the mud wall of self. Across the lowly threshold with bowed heads, angels of ecstasy and self-giving pass. And lodged in an inner sanctuary of dream, the makers of the image of deity live. Namaste. Jai Ma.